Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. Your host, Eric Davis, exploring the cultures of consciousness. I'm really looking forward to this show because we're going to be talking about one of my favorite artists and figures in the L.A. occult artistic demi-monde, the woman Cameron. And just a little background from my side. I first heard about Cameron, who currently has some of her art up at the MoCA Pacific Design Center. The show is called Cameron Songs for the Witch Woman. She died in the 1990s, and I first heard about her, I think the way most people heard about her, through the story of Jack Parsons, the famous JPL rocket scientist / OTO sex magician who died most mysteriously in an explosion in 1952. And we'll talk more about the story about how Jack Parsons hooked up with his Scarlet Woman, Cameron, and then Cameron's adventures after that. But when I found out about Cameron, started getting intrigued with her. She's a very interesting figure because it's very elusive. And even as a historian willing to get down and dirty with archives and with connections with collectors who are fascinated with her work and seeking out the few films, including some obscure films that she's been in, there's still the sense of not really knowing exactly who she is, where she's coming from, what's going on with her, and that's part of the mystery and wonder of her art, much of which she burned, but luckily there's a decent amount still around, and I haven't seen the show yet, but I'm making my plans for an L.A. Visit just to see the show, and we're lucky today. We're going to be speaking with Tanya Layden, who wrote a wonderful cover story for the LA Weekly about Cameron recently. And so we'll be talking about her and some more stuff that didn't get into the article and just reflecting on this really fascinating life, because I think it's not just that Cameron was a very interesting person who did really very interesting and wonderful art that really speaks both to her unique vision and her interest, her lifelong interest in esoteric practices and ideas. But it really kind of captures some of the enchantment of the occult visionary realm in a unique way that's quite powerful. But she also raises some interesting questions about women and men and occultism and how people are remembered and how people avoid history and how people try to write themselves into history. And so there's a lot of stuff around her that's worth exploring. And to help us do that, of course, we'll have our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Dao. Hi, Maja.
Hi, Eric. How's it going?
Pretty good, pretty good. I have to say, I know, I'm actually glad you haven't seen the show yet. You told me that in our little Skype chat, because that way you and I can go together. But I'm also a little surprised. I would think that would be like must do. That says that you are a very busy camper.
It's true. Halloween is my busiest season of the year as a witch. And I had so many, I think I did too many events this Halloween. Some of them nailed it. And then others were kind of dead.
So, what was the top one? What was the one that nailed it?
I did. It's funny because I did two seances. One was for people and one was for cats. And the people one went really well, and the cats one was sort of a dud.
Wow. So how did the seance work? Was it just you? How did? What was the medium? The process?
Well, I usually work with another medium, this friend of mine, and she's fantastic. And I usually don't do mediumship like on a regular basis. I don't do medium readings for people as a general rule, but I've had, like, for some reason working with this woman, we just like get it going on. And she actually wasn't present at the other one. I had invited her, but she couldn't make it. So It's funny. It's like I lost my Dumbo magic feather or something. That's kind of what it felt like.
Well, you know, that just shows that there's something that's actually happening when it's happening. I mean, you know, it's...
Yeah, exactly.
You got to stumble sometimes. But, I'd never spoken with mediumship about mediumship with you before. I didn't know you did that kind of work. That's interesting. Do you use anything? You just close your eyes? How does that happen?
Well, usually, and it's true, I don't usually do mediumship just because it can be a little janky in my experience. And, you know, it either goes or it doesn't go, and there's really nothing you can do if it doesn't go. Like, there's no fluffing it up. So, but I just kind of focus and concentrate and, you know, invite it in, and then usually we'll get pretty good hit, but then sometimes just nothing goes. And of course, that's the whole history of skepticism on mediumship, right? Is like, that's a big part of it. And what really took out a lot of the spiritualist seances was a lot of it just not working or not, you know, producing the goods, which it's always funny because sometimes it does work, but then sometimes it absolutely doesn't. So it can be a very confusing thing, a lot of this work, because it's not really consistent.
Yeah, that's I could imagine that being rather tricky. I had a pretty uneventful weekend. I had all this stuff planned, but in the last minute, I ended up not going out on Halloween and just sort of stayed at home and worked. But I got a lot done. So I mean, marching towards the dissertation. So that was actually pretty good. I did, however, get to see. We had Scott Levkoff on the show a couple of weeks ago, and
I did
see his Spookeasy. Which was really quite excellent, and it was a little unnerving. I have to say, they did a good job. It was like in addition to having the show on the stage, which was sort of like a funny vaudeville, but sort of with a spooky kind of voodoo overlay to it. They had a lot of wandering characters who were kind of doing, you know, kind of creepy, vague things, and they were sort of ghosts, and you'd have these verbal interactions with them, and I thought, oh, this will just be kind of silly, but they were actually kind of a little uncanny and bizarre. So really, gave me a good taste for what can be done with the Halloween vibe. So it was a good
fun
weekend.
You know, I feel like that time is just, it's the time of year to explore that stuff. You know, no matter what happens, it should just be fun.
Excellent. Well, with that, we'll bring Tanya Layden onto the show. Tanya, thanks for joining us and talking about camera.
Thank you.
Well, why don't you just tell us a little bit about like how you got into her and ended up writing this long piece? I mean, I know you do a lot of journalism and you write about a lot of stuff for a lot of different people, not necessarily much on the occult or this exclusively or anything. It's not necessarily your beat exactly. But so, how did you come to get really interested in this?
Well, I mean, it is, in a way, I do write a lot about different things, but occult has always been like a secret beat. I actually wrote about Maja for LA Weekly for the People issue, wrote about a couple of other occult figures. Whenever there is an occult event in LA, I'm always the first to jump on it. But, you know, they're kind of few and far between.
That's true. That makes sense.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, I do. I'll write about anything from food to cannibals and Fiji to, you know, I guess that's the same thing, but lots of different things I'll write about. But Cameron has always kind of been a passion of mine the last 4 years. I came across her on a tour through this company, which Maja is acquainted with, Esoteric. They do these magnificent tours around Los Angeles of kind of like a hidden portions of the city that not a lot of people know about. And I happened to be on one tour for, it was Pasadena. And of course, you know, one of the stops in Pasadena was the Parsonage, which is where Jack Parsons had kind of created, the Agape Lodge was this lodge that, you know, was related to Aleister Crowley, and it didn't have an actual place. It was more a state of mind and kind of a group of people, but its home base ended up being this home on Orange Grove Avenue, and we stopped there. And Richard and Kim, who run the tour, gave us the rundown. And, I mean, I was blown away by the story, by the fact that one of the co-founders of JPL was a black magician, had dropped out of college, was not formally trained, and that he was just such an intriguing figure. And then, you know, they talked a little bit about the Babylon working ritual, which Cameron had participated in, and they actually unknowingly to herself. And I was just, you know, I came home and I went to ye olde Wikipedia and looked it up. And actually, sometime in the meantime, I had read Sex and Rockets about Jack Parsons, published by Feral House. And it was, you know, kind of expanded upon that story. In fact, I think that's probably where they drew a lot of, you know, a lot of what they had spoken about on the tour. But the thing that kind of bothered me about, you know, these instances was that really Cameron was barely mentioned by name, if at all. And she was really just known as the Elemental. She was kind of like this nameless, faceless woman who had, you know, kind of, to me, seemed to be very instrumental in the occult scene in Los Angeles. So after going on Wikipedia, I found the Cameron Parsons Foundation, which is based in Santa Monica. I called them up, spoke with a man who has become what I consider a very good friend, Scott Hobbs, and he was a good friend of Cameron's and was basically entrusted with her estate, and kind of made it a mission, because Cameron was very reticent about selling her art. As you mentioned, she destroyed a lot of it. For her art was not a commodity. It was a body of work that really just spoke to her life, you know, spoke of her life story, kind of illustrated her life story and her magical workings. So he's kind of been the guardian of all her work, and he is an Iyengar yoga expert. He's just a great guy. But, you know, in the beginning, he said he even admitted that he has been approached by a lot of people about Cameron who are interested, mostly usually guys who come to him through the same story about Jack Parsons. And, you know, he mentioned that he was very protective over her, and that that generally, like, it's hard to explain. Like, he was just very, very glacial in his, like, you know, kind of opening up about Cameron. It took 4 years.
And that was Tanya. I want to mention too, like, I remember talking to you about Cameron. I mean, that was like years ago. Like, you were looking into this stuff like way before it's cool. You know, you were too cool for school, but you literally were finding out about her when she was still very obscure. This was before they had any of the like filmings of the Wormwood Star and stuff like that. So you kind of like peeked into there before it was as large knowledge as it is now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of my to really find out like the source of things. And with Cameron, you know, I just was like, who was the woman? Who was the elemental? Who was the person that L. Ron Hubbard and Jack Parsons used in the Babylon working ritual? And then, you know, then they're kind of evolved this whole mythos about her. Like, she was a witch. She was this, you know, the writings that I found about her were very, in a way, sensationalist. And they were, you know, they're not a lot. And, you know, I realized we're all human, and there is a human behind that. And I wanted to get to who was Cameron as an individual, what prompted her art, what prompted her, you know, her, like, what was her spirituality, which I ended up discovering had really evolved over time. It began, you know, she really grew up kind of in a Christian, very, you know, as a corn-fed woman in the Midwest. And her spirituality evolved over time, and at the end of her life, she was actually really involved in the Hopi culture and the Native American, and she was a Tai Chi master. Like, she was really all over the place spiritually. So, yeah, I mean, I just started to slowly kind of uncover her life through the help of Scott Hobbs and the Cameron Parsons Foundation. And, you know, eventually, like, very slowly, he began to trust me. We had a few mutual friends, which helped. And he kind of saw that it wasn't, you know, I wasn't doing this for myself. I was doing this for her. I wanted her story to be told. I didn't even care if my byline was on the LA Weekly story that ended up being on the cover. I really just wanted her story to be told, and I felt that it had been time. I mean, she died in 1995. It's almost been 20 years since she was gone.
Yeah, you know, so, I just want to say a few things about, I mean, everything you said made a lot of sense to me, because there's a wonderful quotation in your article from David Meltzer, who was, of course, a, you know, old school, you know, beat underground poet, also interested in spirituality and esoteric mysticism. But he talks about how, you know, he was friends with Cameron, what a wonderful person she was, and her art was very powerful. But then almost everyone he meets who knows anything about her comes from this sort of, you know, interest in Jack Parsons and this sort of OTO, you know, line, and it does sort of weirdly distort her. And so I thought maybe it might be interesting to sort of explain a little bit about what that connection was, you know, just boiling it down. At some point, you know, Jack Parsons decides that he wants to invoke an elemental, and so he goes out to the Mojave and does a ritual, and then comes back, and then, according to him, you know, bang, the next thing he does is meet Cameron, and they, you know, fall into bed for 2 weeks, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, there was probably a little bit more time in between the ritual and the event, but it raises a really interesting question about gender politics and the occult, which is that he says, yeah, "Oh, now I have my elemental." But to refer to a human woman as an elemental, even a woman who clearly, even though at that point she was not an esoteric practitioner, was already clearly a very powerful woman. You know, was part of the armed services. The photographs you see a very self-possessed, strong, you know, kind of vital person. You know, that's already kind of weird. In the introduction to the Songs for the Witch Woman, which is the book that sort of came out in concordance with the exhibit from Folger in the UK, William Breeze, who's like the current OTO, you know, muckety muck, writes about this and talks about having a conversation with Cameron where he's like, "You're not an elemental. You wouldn't ask this question whether you're an elemental. If you were an elemental, elementals aren't really kind of people." So there's this weird way in which she functions in that imagination as some kind of non-human creature, which was partly what Parsons was doing. But then, of course, also they had a real relationship and there was a real love and a lot of interesting back and forth there too. So it kind of says something about how, at least for a certain kind of male cult imagination, it's kind of, there's a little danger in how these sort of powerful women figures get imagined. And so it's nice to move beyond that.
Yeah, and I mean, that really was my goal. You know, of course, was to understand really exactly her role in that. But, you know, the wonderful thing about having access, and I was, you know, when I said, "Listen, I'm writing a story," I called Scott and said, "I'm writing a story for LA Weekly." I really wanted it to be a feature. I really pushed for it to be kind of as big as it. He ended up putting me, I mean, in touch with an amazing, amazing amount of figures, including Cameron's daughter, Crystal, and Cameron's granddaughter, Iris, who's actually my age, you know, who they really gave me a picture of her, that of Cameron, that was unlike any I had read about, or even the other figures that I had spoken with, you know, with Meltzer, with Russ Tamblyn, Shirley Berman, Wallace Berman's widow, They gave me a picture of Cameron as a real woman, but they also, you know, stressed a lot about how she was in some ways spooky. She was kind of a little bit out there because, you know, once Jack died, she kind of started to embrace Crowley, I think, in an effort to kind of just become a little bit closer to him and understand what motivated him as a magician, as a scientist. And they gave me, you know, they all had that impression of her as a really, you know, wonderful, gracious woman. And then, but once I spoke with Crystal and Iris, that's when I really made the breakthrough of what kind of a woman Cameron was. You know, actually, there was a quotation that was just really, really cute that Iris was talking about, just little things about, like, how Cameron didn't like to wear underwear. And this is her as a grandmother. Okay? This is her, like, in her late 60s, you know. And
no, that's
be, like,
a great detail.
Yeah, she'd be walking down the street in her home in West Hollywood, you know, like, in a long flowy dress, and she'd be like, "Grandma, you need to put, you know, a slip on. We can see everything, you know." And little things about, like, how when Iris was acting up, Cameron would just come and dump a big old bucket of ice water on her, and it would calm her down. You know, these, like, little wonderful things that didn't make it into the article, but that I found really kind of gave us a glimpse into her. You know, her persona, I mean, her humanity.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
Another thing about the, that I wanted to stress that you had mentioned is that I've always thought of her as kind of this secret link in a way, because, you know, the fact that, you know, whatever you want to talk about the importance of Thelema, it's one of the most significant magical systems in the 20th century. It's incredibly influential, whatever you think about Crowley. And it's not accidental, I think, in the history of California and in the history of Los Angeles that, you know, the strongest center for Thelema when Crowley actually died was in Los Angeles. And even if Jack Parsons is, I think, rightly seen by occult historians and people in the OTO as a, you know, interesting fellow, but an erratic and ultimately unsuccessful magician in many ways, he did set in motion a sort of cultural current that I think is very important, and that in many ways Cameron carried that after his death.
And, well, and it's interesting
whether
too,
it was through inspiration and or through her own intention or through her work. I mean, those are all bound up, but her appearance in the Kenneth Anger film, her especially her friendships with Wallace Berman, with George Herms, and these very important, you know, underground beat artists who had a lot of esotericism in their work, who were encouraged in their esotericism. And I think kind of saw her as sort of an inspiration, as a sort of transmitter of this current that then goes on into the 60s and all that. So it's really, you know, kind of heartwarming that she's getting this attention, albeit after, well, she didn't really want the attention during her life anyway.
No.
So it's probably just as well. But I do think that she's sort of a secret link to understanding the kind of the history and the currents that are running through L.A., art esotericism, and so I assume that you know also see that. And I was actually just wondering, with in the conversations you had, did you also did you get other impressions or other information about her influence on other people, how she inspired them, or how they saw her as participating in other kinds of things that people were doing, you know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s.
Oh, yes. In fact, I mean, you know, obviously the greatest asset. I mean, my background is history. I have a degree in history. And so it was always drilled into my head that the best sources are the primary sources. So fortunately, there have, you know, at the Cameron Parsons Institute, there are actually a lot of recordings of Cameron, interviews with Bill Breeze, whom you mentioned, interviews with Scott Hobbs. There are a series of great interviews of her in right before she died, which, you know, really gave a great, we're just a really interesting kind of way to kind of connect with her, you know, towards the end of her life, even though I never knew her, to kind of see her looking back on her life and how she felt she was, you know, her influence. But the probably with what you're talking about, the best source I had was an interview that is actually at the Getty. And it's with Sandra Leonard Starr, who is, she's an art historian, and she, in 1988, curated an exhibition of assemblage art. It was called Lost and Found in California, Four Decades of Assemblage Art. And as part of that, she interviewed Cameron. And Cameron talked a lot about, you know, a little bit about her history, you know, her biography as a child and growing up, and a little bit about Parsons, but mostly about her involvement in the LA art scene. And it kind of through that became apparent to me how really I think she probably was the catalyst for the beat movement in Los Angeles, because she kept mentioning that there really was, you know, after the war, there was nothing going on in LA in terms of art. There was some poetry, obviously film was a big part of it, but in terms of art, that it was not, LA was not known for its art at all at that time. And she kind of, you know, changed that together with Wallace Berman, with, you know, their whole coterie with Kenneth Anger, whose films, you know, you could argue they're films, but they're art films. And she, you know, she really did have a big influence. She was older than Berman. She had, you know, quite a bit of influence as an artist, not just the art itself, but the way that she lived her life. She was very itinerant. She was had this kind of, you know, nomadic existence where there were times where she said she was homeless. She really just did everything in service of her art.
Well, one question I had about one thing I learned from your article, or many things, but is that she met the Bermans rather early, because they met Jack Parsons as well, and I thought it was
right.
Years yeah. after that. So I don't even remember whether it was in the article, but what exactly was the circumstances of their meeting? I mean, just to say that Wallace Berman again is one of the spearheads of this LA. You know, scene. He's kind of, you know, like a, I don't know, you know, I'm sort of like a Gary Snyder, you know, whatever, not like Gary Snyder, but someone who's like a poet, an esotericist, yeah. a practitioner, very influential. He created a whole social milieu as well as being himself an impressive artist. And he did that partly through his Semina journal later on, where he would sort of send it was kind of like a mail art. Form of artistry, also a kind of assemblage, because he would take bits and pieces of different texts and poems and send them out to a sort of a network of friends, and that helped kind of create not just an art object, but an artistic esoteric milieu that was very important and influential. And so his relationship to Cameron always seemed to me really key, but I didn't realize it was so young, so or it happened so early.
Yeah.
So what was the story there?
Yeah, I mean, I actually have the quotation right here. She said she met him in 51, 52. It was right before Jack Parsons died. She met him, she said, through a man named John Carruthers, who was working in contemporary furniture. And that's actually at the time where Wallace Berman was working. He was working as a professional furniture distressor. That was his day job. And so he knew John Carruthers, and John Carruthers, I guess, was a mutual friend of Cameron's and Wallace Berman's. And so he sort of put them in touch. Carruthers eventually left. And at that time, Berman was dating Shirley Berman, who is an amazing woman. I mean, I've met very few women as like just like wonderful as she is, and just so forthcoming in the interview. And they met. They went to a garden party, and she, you know, Shirley said that they were incredibly beautiful. Another, you know, they met. Shirley told me that she met Jack Parsons twice, and that first time was at a party that Cameron and Jack had thrown. The second time was it was at this dinner that, you know, was just like a very kind of small, intimate dinner at Parsons and Cameron's home. And by that time, they had, you know, they were married. And they went in, and Shirley said that the whole time Cameron's cooking and they're all sitting down, there was like six of them. I think the Carruthers were probably the other couple. And Jack was just not. And she said all of a sudden he just appeared in the doorway. And she said she didn't know if it was the lighting or something, but he just appeared. It was just all of a sudden. Then he sat down, didn't say a word, ate his dinner, and then just disappeared. And that was the second time that Shirley Berman saw him. And that was it.
That's wonderful.
And so once he died, and he died so violently, Cameron and Wallace kind of and Shirley became close. They ended up kind of helping her through her grief, and that's how David Meltzer, he remembers seeing them at a bookstore in La Cienega, owned by Norman Rose at the time, and he says, you know, that was right around that time that Cameron was very down, but he remembers seeing the three of them and saying, wow, you know, that's like a. And he was pretty young at the time, David Meltzer, you know, he was in his teens and was just really intrigued and then kind of got involved in their, they did have that little bit crossover where the Bermans did meet Parsons and was very, you know, in the, it wasn't after, it was
right.
Sort of during.
Yeah,
yeah.
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 And it's wonderful that there are films from the 50s because, You get a hit off of Cameron, just her visual appearance, even though it's a film and there's makeup and there's a whole structure or whatever, like her energy, particularly in inauguration of the Pleasure Dome, but also in the Harrington short, The Wormwood Star, which you used to be able to rent. I rented it for an occult film night that I did, you know, over a decade ago. In San Francisco, and then for a while you couldn't find it at all, and then now it's more available. I don't know if it's officially available, but it's sort of, you know, out there in internet land. But that is a remarkable piece, and you see her do a sort of ritual at the beginning, and you know, you hear her poetry, you see her artwork, and it's a really a vibrant way to get, so you can actually get a sense a bit of what this person was, even though she's very enigmatic in a lot of ways. Do you know much more details about the Harrington film in terms of, you know, what that ritual is, or when and where did it happen, or, you know, anything about that really fascinating 10-minute film?
I mean, unfortunately, I mean, I just know there is an interview with Harrington, a videotape interview about Cameron, where he, you know, and he was one of these other figures, like a lot of her friends, who really did not understand, did not want to understand her magical, her magical practices. He was more, he came at it from her, you know, attracted to her artwork. And he really wanted it to be kind of a document of her artwork, which ended up being kind of prescient for him, because a lot of that artwork that's in that film ended up being destroyed by Cameron. It was a villa. I wish I could tell you more.
I mean, you could just go endlessly. In fact, I realize I'm kind of nerding out here, you know, on this podcast, because this is just a subject of great fascination. But we got to take a break here.
Okay.
You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou here with Eric Davis, and today we have such a treat. We're talking about Cameron, the Witchy Woman, with talented author and journalist Tanya Layden. And it's really fascinating to go back a little bit to something Eric was talking about, her as a woman, as the elemental of choice in these magical operations. So if you look at it, like, Crowley had used his own pregnant wife at one time as one of those kind of things, as an elemental to channel, right, in Egypt, like on the pyramids. So Crowley himself had done this with a woman, and what happened to the woman afterwards was very kind of intense. I don't know you guys know the story or like how the story went to this woman's like basic unraveling as she went through this. And I do think it's important to see the difference between these, you know, male, not to make a man-woman thing, but there's these powerful male occult figures who seem to like involve themselves with some of these women. And then you like either never hear of the women again or they kind of like go to pieces or a lot of weird stuff happens. So there is like something about Cameron where she, it's like she was able to, like Eric said, be self-possessed or keep herself through it. She didn't like get lost, which does happen if you look throughout history. And I mean, if you think about it, just check this out, okay? She was married to the man who invented rocket fuel, right? Like that is like some mojo. Like if you think about it, that's like, he's like conquered the planet Earth. So if you imagine like who this man who invented the reason why we can go to outer space chooses a woman, I mean, like you have to be fascinated with her only on that end. But then like you pointed out additionally, she had her own, she could hold her own space. Which I was curious if in your research, as you mentioned, when you found out more about like kind of her as a woman and how she kind of didn't want, like Eric said, a lot of that attention, what do you feel like she just kind of did it to keep herself, to not get like caught up in the hype? Or what do you think was like, did you get a sense of her personal sense of herself and keeping herself private?
Yeah, I mean, I think it had a lot to do with you know, when Jack was killed in that explosion, which she believed he was murdered because at the time he had been in, under investigation by the FBI as a communist. And so she really, at the end of her life, really always believed he was murdered. You know, his former colleagues kind of attested, said that, you know, he was pretty reckless with the way he handled chemicals sometimes and that it was entirely possible that it was an accident. But for me, like, what astounds me about her is that, you know, so soon after his death that she, you know, she was obviously grieving, she was heartbroken, and she was, you know, a mess, as you know, it's the love of your life. It dies in an explosion at the age of 37, you know, while you're out getting gas in the car for a trip the next day. And how she was able to bounce back from that through her art, through her friendships, you know, with the Burmans and others, you know, like within 3 years, she made Wormwood Star. Within 3 years, she had made Inauguration of the Pleasure Dome. You know, she really, and she was very prolific at that time as an artist, I think, you know, working through her grief with her art. And I think that strength was really inspiring to me, because it seems like it was a form of therapy for her. And even she had admitted, you know, she was very interested in psychoanalysis, in therapy. And I think she even was probably quite conscious of it. But in terms of the woman, I really think it was because right after his explosion, you know, there was a reporter who was living at the parsonage. And I don't know if he was the source, but all this stuff had come out that this rocket scientist was a black magician and that he was in a sex cult, and all this stuff came in. She started getting all these weird reporters and, you know, strange people knocking on her door and stalking her. And I mean, you know, in the wake of such a horrible accident, that's horrible, you know, just to begin with, but then it kind of continued. And I think she really dealt with that a lot in her life, was just, you know, she wanted to be known as an artist, not as the widow of this man. And that kind of is really what made her very gun shy with the press, which is what, you know, why there really is only one surviving publicly available interview, which, you know, as I mentioned, it is at the Getty. Anyone can go listen to it. You have to go physically to the Getty Center, but anyone can go listen to it. It's a really great interview. She's mostly talking about her work because it is within the context of this art exhibition that she had some pieces in. But, Yeah, I think that is the main reason why she ended up becoming so private. And people, it seems, you know, at the end of her life as well, you know, just talking to Crystal and Iris, Cameron's daughter and granddaughter, you know, they even remembered people just randomly showing up on her doorstep. And this is when she's in her 60s, 70s, you know, wanting to talk about Jack Parsons.
Right.
And scary. Like, I mean, that's
yeah.
creepy, you know. And so I began to understand why she was so reticent with the press. But having said that, she did mention in the Star interview that you know, that Jack wanted her, that he was kind of grooming her to have a public role, that he recognized her worth as an artist, and he wanted her to kind of, you know, not like he knew that he was going to be gone, but that he always wanted her to be a little bit more of, you know, a forthcoming with her art, which kind of indicates that at that time she already wasn't.
Well, so, and let me ask you this too. Did she make art like as prolifically before that time, or was that really like her big burgeoning
yeah,
through her
Yeah,
grief?
She had, in fact, the house, they lived in a coach house, and the attic was her art studio. The main floor, from what I understand, was their living quarters, and then the kind of garage or basement type area was Jack's lab.
Right.
So she grew up in Belle Plaine, Iowa. She was born in 1922. As Eric mentioned, she served in the armed forces. She was in the Waves. She came to Los Angeles because at that time her whole family ended up working at JPL, which was interesting that she would end up meeting the co-founder.
Are you serious? Her whole family was working there?
Yeah, before she met him.
Wow.
And I know it's really interesting. Like, I mean, this article that I ended up doing, it's literally half of what I wrote. And even
yeah.
then I felt like I was leaving out a lot. I'd like to kind of assemble it all someday, in a broader form, hopefully
Speaking of that, I'm curious, I mean, what you think of the existing, unauthorized Cameron biography, Wormwood Star, Spencer Kanza.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of curious how, since you know more about it, my impression is that while there was, he clearly did a lot of work, I found it slightly untrustworthy in some ways, he also portrayed her as quite unstable psychologically, and
yeah.
clearly she was an erratic person, but I walked away from that not feeling that it really helped really enlighten me that much about her.
Yeah. I agree. I actually read, there are two editions. Supposedly the second edition is much better, but I read both. And, you know, I do admire the level of research that Kansa had done. He didn't have the access to the recordings that I had, we interviewed a lot of the same people. I won't name names, but, you know, the same people that we interviewed, when I spoke with them, they said that Kansa misquoted them, at length. I saw quotations
right.
in his book. It was sensationalized, and in some ways that's how Sex and Rockets also was, you know, even though it was a great read and there are, you know, probably more truths than untruths in it, it's more about the feeling that I get walking away from reading these people about Parsons and about Cameron, and in some ways they're similar because they ended up, they feel more like cult figures in some ways, maybe even cartoonish figures like action heroes or something. Like they didn't come across as real people. And after I read his book, I really wanted to get to learn more about her as a real person. And, you know, he did do a lot of research. There are people that I interviewed that said that they were misquoted in that book. He does, you know, kind of try to put it in a historical context, which I think in some ways didn't work because he really could have been talking a lot more about her, but he didn't, you know, it wasn't an unauthorized biography. It was, he really didn't have the level of access that I had. Fortunately, I mean, I was lucky, you know, it wasn't, it really was because I gained the trust over a long period of time, as Maja knows, you know, with the Institute, for them to be able to give me her recordings, her, you know.
Well, it's not lucky. It's that you did the work to, you know, show that you were, you know, had the responsibility to deal with this. So
I guess maybe more patience would be the right word.
Right.
You know, like I really had the patience to kind of.
I mean, Tanya, you're confronted with this woman who's like so mysterious and also even like partially kind of, you know, poo talked about. So it's like you're confronted with this situation where you had to totally trust your instinct that there was something deeper with her. Like even amidst all the kind of sordid, whatever, sensationalistic stuff that has been presented with her, you had a feeling that there was something more. And so like that's rare to get people to notice those kinds of things when there's so much, like, I mean, look at the story. There's L. Ron Hubbard. There's Aleister Crowley. It's easy to see how she can get lost in the mix of that, right? Just from
you know, going back to, like, why she was so private, I mean, another reason, and this is in the article, was, you know, her famous peyote vision painting, which she had done in the desert after kind of overdosing on peyote. She had this really scandalous image of you know, herself, a woman who looks a lot like her, having sex with an alien, and that ended up being in the Ferris Gallery show that was shut down on the first day it opened. And Wallace Berman wanted her to kind of defend the drawing in court, and she had said in the interview with Sandra Lynard Starr that people didn't realize, he didn't realize where I was, what I had dealt with, you know, with Jack's death. And she didn't want that. She didn't want to have to, you know, have that kind of big, and that was sort of in the wake of the, you know, obscenity trial or with Howell, right after Ginsburg and Howell had that. And I think they kind of wanted to kind of not capitalize, but just sort of drive home the point that art is not pornography, no matter what, if it comes from an artistic impetus. But she didn't even want to have anything to do with that either. And that was kind of another setback for her, because she was like, whoa, you know, I want to be, I think she just always wanted to be recognized for something positive. And she did want to be recognized as a feminist, you know, as a proto-feminist. She was she wanted people to understand that women were as strong and as vital, if not more, in creating things than men. And even towards the end of her life, you know, as a grandma, Iris, or as her granddaughter, Iris, told me, you know, men were not her favorite. She was extremely distrustful of men.
Well, and it's funny because Eric and I had the pleasure, when we did a screening of Occult LA, Kenneth Anger was there, and he shared with us. Were you there, Tanya, too?
Yes.
Yeah, when he got up and he told his story of his relationship with Cameron, I mean, he presented her as not being like, you know, she certainly wasn't affectionate towards him, right? He said that she was kind of very stern towards him, and that, you know, he had to kind of really work on it. But it was so delightful to hear, like, his personal experience of her. I was so glad that he shared that day. But he did. It was like you could tell she had just been maybe way injured, and that maybe contributed to that experience.
Yeah,
that
and there is, you know, an interview also with him at the Cameron Parsons Foundation where he kind of goes into that a little bit more.
I just wanted to clarify just one thing. What do you think about her, you know, psychological stability? You know, obviously we're talking about an artist, we're talking about a bohemian, we're talking about an occult practitioner, so we're already in a weird zone.
Right,
but
yeah.
I think you have some lines in your piece about that precisely, but that your impression and the impression of most of the people who you were talking to was that she was no more or less sane than any one who's inhabiting an already somewhat peculiar world like that.
Yeah, I mean, to me, she came across, like, as I researched her more, as probably the most sane woman, given her set of circumstances, that you could ask for. Like, anyone else would probably crumble under so much weirdness. It really made her stronger. Everything that she dealt with made her stronger. And she was sane. She was, I mean, you know, maybe not the best mother. Her daughter, Crystal, still, you know, loves her. Still, she worked, you know, on her art. In fact, there's, when I spoke with Crystal, you know, she had a beautiful story, a couple of beautiful stories, but one was when they were in Pioneertown. They were living in Pioneertown, and Crystal was probably about 15 at the time, and she remembers just seeing Cameron outside sitting on a table drawing, and she wanted to cry. I said, "Why do you want to cry? Why did you want to cry?" And she said, "Because that's how I always saw her." So, you know, I realized that Cameron's main goal, even more than maybe her daughter, was her art. And that's what drove her, and I think that's what kept her sane. And even when she destroyed it, it was kind of an act of sanity because she was liberating herself from it. She was, you know, it was almost like a weird alchemical act where she was literally taking all the pain that she had put on that canvas and set it on fire and transformed it into a new element that was, you know, a way that she no longer was tied to. And that, you know, that Crystal said that I just thought was really interesting and adorable and kind of a testament to, you know, to Cameron's just charm and the kind of sense of magic around her is that, you know, it was Cameron's birthday and nobody remembered in Pioneer Town, and Cameron didn't want to say anything because it's her birthday. She didn't want to be like, "You assholes, it's my birthday, none of you remembered." But as it happened, for some reason, some entire, like, platoon of performers in Civil War outfits all of a sudden showed up. I guess they were filming. And, like, totally unrelated to Cameron's birthday, but they came, like, with a brass band. They came and did this whole show at Pioneer Town, and then at the end, Cameron said, "Oh, that was for my birthday." You know, cute. Like these little cute moments that they juxtapose, you know, her seriousness. You know, there were just things, humor in her. You know, you saw like she had a sense of humor. She was kind of a wisecracker. She was, you know, she was a tough broad, but she was also, she was funny. She wasn't like a mean, you know, witchy, bitchy lady. She was gentle. She was, you know, loved her granddaughter Iris. Like, Iris loves her, you know. When we met at the exhibit at the opening, we both cried because it's actually, when you go there, you know, you can see these shitty JPEGs, like, sorry, I don't want to, like, cuss, but ugly JPEGs on the internet, right? And they, they're pretty. You can see her artwork. You can see that they're pretty, but really when you see the artwork in person, I don't know. There's something about, like, they resonate, like physically resonate. You can feel the emotion that she put. And even though I had seen these works of art and put them in the article and, you know, seen them hundreds of times, when I saw them, it really, like, just charged everybody in there, I think. And I think anyone who goes can feel that. You can really, it's palpable. You can feel, you know, what she put into it.
Right. And also just as a plug for folks who aren't going to be able to make it to L.A., that the Songs for the Witch Woman, though it is not inexpensive, is a wonderful book that does a large reproduction of a series of poems and images by Cameron, and so there's some of her artwork in there that's actually had, like, sort of proper reproduction, unlike most of the things.
It's a beautiful book, and there's also a really great catalog for the show as well. It's a hardbound catalog. It's, you know, a nice looking little volume that has all the works and a lot of text in the book that kind of
Oh, that was, I had a question for you. Is that I knew that, that she had put out a book of poetry at some point in her career. And
yes.
Is that what the Songs of the Witch Woman is, or is that another
no,
book? And
that's
if so, is there any movement to get that out or reprint it or anything?
It's called, yeah, it's called Black Pilgrimage. I believe it was from 1964. It's a little chapbook, basically, of poetry. I have yet to see it. I don't know whether there are plans to reissue it. I don't even know who has the rights to it. But yeah, I would love to read that, the poetry too. I haven't had a chance to track it down. I've been looking for it. I think it may be at this point somewhere online. But yeah, it's a highly valuable piece. If someone comes across it, you know, it's rare.
Yeah, that's I mean, there's still a lot of like tidbits that should be collected, you know, in addition is there's, you know, floating around online, there's this correspondence from Parsons to Cameron where he's kind of instructing her on magic. And it's a very interesting document. There's very tender parts, and there's also some kind of weird, you know, I'm the wizard kind of parts to it.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, there's really more here to this story, and I think it's really significant. And I hope you run with the football. It sounds like you have a lot of you know, you have a rare access to a lot of things, and there might be room for more, you know, more extended. I'm sure there is room for more extended work on her. So,
thank you. Yeah, I hope so too. I mean, this is even just this article has been, you know, quite an undertaking.
Well, that's the thing when you write about these subjects and these kinds of people, then you have peculiar kinds of responsibilities that
right.
come upon you as a writer. So it's sometimes difficult, but it's also can be very worthwhile.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, we're going to have to wind it up there. Tanya, thank you so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you.
And folks, please go read Tanya Layden's article at the LA Weekly. And she also has her own website at Tanya Layden, I think it's .com.
Yes.
So that will do for now. Hopefully I'll run into you somewhere at the show.
I would love to meet you. Yes.
Yeah. And from Meet and Maja, to all you out there, keep your minds open.